Lowe's early Black Friday deals are going fast. Don't miss up to 50% off select major appliances. Plus, up to an extra 25% off when you bundle select major appliances. And with Christmas around the corner, you're going to need more string lights, right? Save $4 on GE LED 100-count string lights, now just $5.98. Lowe's, we help, you save. Valid through 12/3. Selection varies by location. Select locations only. While supplies last. See Lowe's.com for more details.
This is The Big Breakdown, a long look back at some of the biggest stories we're covering for you at the Hidden Killers podcast and True Crime Today. This is Hidden Killers with Tony Bruschi. Here now, Tony Bruschi.
Brian Koberger. Behind bars, it's not going so well. We're going to break all this down in terms of what is happening to him right now. Is it common? Is it legal? And what happens from here with Koberger behind bars? Eric Faddis, defense attorney, former prosecutor, joining us to give us some insight. And we've talked about the conditions and high-profile inmates before. What's coming out of the Idaho Maximum Security Institution is painting a far more intense picture here of what's going on, but not completely unheard of. I mean, from your perspective, Eric, as a former prosecutor and as a defense attorney, how common is it for inmates to be targeted like this in a way, in this sort of way? And does law enforcement consider this cruel and unusual punishment, or is this just pretty much normal, you know, what you're going to get in a prison?
You know, gosh, it is rather common at multiple levels, at the prison level, even at a county jail level. Prisons and places of incarceration are not nice places, and sometimes they're filled with not so nice people. And so that's to what these folks are kind of subjected to. There is a concern about cruel and unusual punishment under the Eighth Amendment. Certainly, you know, some taunting and making someone uncomfortable doesn't rise to that level, but further actions and threats of violence and stuff like that could. And so that there are some considerations to think about.
What's interesting here, and from what we're learning from various sources, is that Brian Koberger arrived at the prison facility. He was put into solitary confinement 23 hours a day. He's in a box. And there are other solitary confinement cells near him, but they're all solitary, as in solitary confinement. But as in any building, you need some sort of ventilation to keep airflow moving, just basic stuff. And they seem to have found a way to use that ventilation system to direct their sounds, not to other prisoners, but directly into Koberger's cell. And they're systematically taking turns, allegedly, tormenting him. Like, they had this planned out. When he was coming, they knew he was coming. And when they did, it's like on shifts. One will go for so long, then they get tired out, the next guy takes over. And then the next guy, 24 hours a day, tormenting Brian Koberger. Are you surprised by this? And I mean, is this a new thing? Is this an effect of the way that we handle cases today on a public forum, where you have podcasts, where you have all these people on social media, and the prisoners have access to see these people and hear these requests? And how are they following through on the public's request to torment the hell out of this man?
Well, look, folks who are incarcerated can devise some ingenious ways to influence their environment. And that includes targeting other inmates. And I think you're right that the mass public exposure and awareness of these cases that didn't necessarily exist in the 40s, the 50s, 60s, things like that, contributes to that. And so all of these, or most of the inmates, know what's going on, know what Koberger's there for, and they got a lot of time on their hands. And so they are going to devise ways to bring about the outcomes they want and to do the things they want. It looks like that's what they're doing here.
Very much. I mean, if you're, and I'm in no way trying to play the part of Koberger's side, I'm just kind of playing the part of, I don't know, I didn't want to say sanity because I am condoning this. I'm not condemning this. But is there point ever? I mean, do they ever in? I know nothing about prisons other than what I've seen on television and that sort of thing. Do they ever clamp down on this? Do they ever go, you know, knock it off, guys? Like, this is too much. This is too much. Even just for the guards to deal with or others to have to deal with in here. Or is it literally just part of the ecosystem? Just as the sky is blue, prisons are going to be loud and taunting and hellish.
You know, on one hand, it is the lay of the land. That's kind of how these things go. And look, there are way more prisoners than there are staff. And so the staff doesn't have the resources or time to be micromanaging, you know, every word that comes out of these people's mouths directed at somebody else. Now, they do have to be careful. If an inmate lodges multiple concerns about threats upon his or her life and jail staff does absolutely nothing, you know, could there be some kind of civil liability in the future? Possibly. And so jail staff has to be aware of how the inmates are treated and whether there are any threats to violence to inmates that appear credible, and then sometimes taking action upon those reports.
Okay, so you got all these guys all shouting at Koberger, going directly into his vent, tormenting him. And the prison has made a statement saying they're aware of the complaints. They're aware of the complaints. It's neither here nor there, basically. I'm going to guess the inmates aren't necessarily the folks that are thinking, gee, I probably shouldn't say something threatening because that could come back to bite me in the ass. I better keep this very clean and really, really keep the terminology correct. They're not. They don't have to worry about that. They're not on a broadcast. They're not on a podcast. They're not worrying. They're just going to say whatever the hell they're going to say. And I'm going to guess a lot of that involves destroying his life or taking it away or orifices of his, things of that nature. That's got to be flying around there. Now, there is an obligation, obviously, in a prison setting to protect a prisoner from physical violence. You can't just have a free-for-all where everybody's getting shanked left and right and nobody's stopping this. That's not how this works. But psychologically, there really isn't much of a anything. There is no safeguard there, is there?
There really isn't. You know, it's not the staff's responsibility to protect the feelings of any of the folks in there. And, you know, one thing to keep in mind, in a prison, you're likely to have some people who are dangerous. And then when you take it up a level to solitary confinement, oftentimes those are individuals involved in gangs. Sometimes they're individuals who have committed sensitive type of crimes. But yeah, there's going to be some of that sort of, you know, kind of schoolyard bullying times a million. And that kind of thing is going to be pretty much just overlooked by the prison. They've got other stuff to worry about. Unless there is a credible and imminent threat on the safety of an inmate, they're probably going to kind of let this ride.
Is there anything that Koberger's defense, and I don't know who's the defense, I don't know if Ann Koberger is still there, or Ann Koberger, Ann Taylor, I keep connecting the two. Let's hope that never happens, Ann, run for your life. Is there any, I mean, I don't know if Ann Taylor is still part of the council or not, but whatever council he has, whatever the state has given him, is there any recourse there? Is there anything they can do about any of this? Or is this Koberger just kind of got to take it?
There are kind of two things that come to mind. One thing that they can consider is if Koberger can compile, like I said, a credible imminent threat on his safety, he can request, you know, a transfer outside of solitary, but that's not the best option for him. He could request a transfer to another facility where this stuff is likely going to happen again. The real only potential out he might have is if he were to develop some kind of physical medical ailment, and that, you know, his circumstances exacerbated that documented medical diagnosis. Under limited circumstances, they can get some kind of relief, but it's usually just transfers and shuffling these folks around to similar environments where the same thing is likely to happen.
There's not a way around it, because you could go down the road of, could this torment him enough to the point where it becomes a psychological problem? Even when we've seen psychological problems arise, I mean, take Richard Allen, for example, in the Delphi case. He was eating his own poop and running into a wall head first, and nobody said, gee, maybe we should take him out of here. Maybe we should do something different. Even when you go to that far, even if we end up seeing Koberger having a nice shit sandwich, which I think they should televise. Does that, I mean, it seems like it takes a lot. It takes a lot for any change to happen. And even if change does happen, at the end of the day, security and protecting his life is going to be, you know, paramount. That's nobody wants him to die on their watch. Eventually, I think somebody's going to have it happen. But if you move him, if he's psychologically damaged, to a mental health type facility, a prison type mental health facility, you're back there exposed. You're out there. You are in a population, a general population, a different type of general population than you would be like in the yard and in the cell. But, you know, hierarchy still lives there. And I think some people even argue at times it's more dangerous in a mental health area because you're dealing with people who have serious mental health problems, you know, beyond just the folks that are behind bars in the normal situation. There is no real route here that seems that this might be as good as it gets for Koberger right now, where the least of his worries are people taunting him through HVAC ventilation. Is that kind of what we're getting at here?
Yeah, you know, and as unpleasant as that might be, I think folks are going to contrast that with the egregious, brutal acts that he admitted to committing and say, hey, tough shit, man. He's in protective custody. He can't get more protected. Even if you were transferred to some kind of mental health unit, there are problems there. And in fact, like you said, he's probably less protected in such an environment. They're usually more open. Usually other inmates have access to you in those mental health wards and divisions of prisons. So this might be as good as it gets, but it's still a hell of a lot better than what his victims got.
Hell of a lot better than what his victims got. And honestly, probably a hell of a lot better than what he would get if he was free in the yard. Let's talk about that for a moment. Let's talk about the prospects of how long can someone stay in solitary confinement? I mean, from your experience and historically, can some people like this high profile that are this targeted, can it go on indefinitely, like for the rest of his life, or does eventually it shift? How do the decisions get made when someone like a Koberger, that high profile, how is that decision made to go, you know what, it's time for a change for him, and let's change some things up from just being in solitary?
You know, in theory, he could be in solitary for years and years. However, what often happens is that they don't keep a person there forever unless you're on death row or something like that. And so what the staff looks at is they look at resources. They look at risk level. They look at historical record of the person while in custody. And you know, there have been a number of high profile folks that have been transferred to general population or some equivalent thereof. And those folks have a target on their back, especially when we're talking about Koberger. Killing young women is usually a taboo crime in prison, and he's done that multiple times over. And so multiple targets on his back, and I don't think they're going to keep him in protective custody forever.
And that's going to be interesting to see what happens then. I mean, Dahmer lasted less than 2 years. I just did a piece yesterday that went through so many high-profile killers, and they don't last long. The target is there. Why is the target there? Let me ask you that, and I think I know the answer, but maybe you can explain it better. Why is there such a target on somebody like Koberger's back, someone who's going to be in prison for the rest of his life? What is the benefit for someone behind bars to go after Brian Koberger?
You know, there are a lot of considerations. There are prison politics at play. You know, even in prison, there is an ethical code, and there are certain crimes and perpetrators who are far less desirable and looked down upon. Like I said, killing young women is usually a no-no in prison. He's done that multiple times over. On top of that, these folks don't have much to lose, especially folks who are in prison for the rest of their lives. And so killing somebody else is not going to to make their situation substantially worse. On top of that, there is some infamy that can be gained, some respect, some notoriety, some fear within those prison walls if you take out a high-profile perpetrator like Koberger. So a number of incentives within those facilities for folks to target Koberger if they can reach him. And there are ways in which he can be reached.
Expand upon that a little bit. Like, what, you know, you get the notoriety, you get, you know, some of the respect in there. I mean, you are behind prison walls. Does that give you more security yourself because you are the one who took out someone like a Brian Koberger? Or does that make you a bigger target to yourself because now you're somewhat infamous? You're the guy who took out Brian Koberger. If somebody takes out the guy who took out Brian Koberger, and maybe you're a guy who took out some other people too, I would think that would make you a bit of a target too. It's like kind of on both ends, like one end's on the feeding chain here, one's way up here. I don't know. Koberger's like low-hanging fruit to a certain extent.
Yeah, I think it's going to depend on the particular ecosystem within that specific prison. But certainly, you know, there is an idea about, like, in prison, kind of keeping your head down, doing your time, not doing too much in there. When you're taking out a high profile inmate and killing him, well, then your name gets around and some folks might give you respect and fear you. Other folks might say, hey, you're the new guy with the target. You know, you think you're this big top dog who took out this high profile inmate. Well, we're going to show you're not the top dog. And so all of those things go on, and it's and on top of that, Tony, these folks have so much time on their hands that all they have to do is think about these kind of things and scheme and plot. And that's how we see, you know, assaults and killings in facilities.
If we could just take the ingenuity of our prison system and the people that are in it and use it for something good. Imagine all the things we could get done beyond license plates. I think there's a lot of ingenuity there. I mean, you're talking people who evaded the system for quite some time usually. And there's a lot of intelligence there. And if they're just using it to torment Brian Koberger, I mean, I'm okay with that one. But again, using it for other things would be lovely. Is there anything? I mean, if you were Brian Koberger's attorney right now, and you're advising him, obviously he's waived, he's not going to appeal, he's just there he's there for the rest of his life. There's no more court hearings for Brian Koberger. But you know, he does have some rights. What are you telling him? What are you telling him how to survive this? How to get on somebody's, I mean, is there getting on somebody's good side? What would you be advising him to survive basically at this point?
You know, some folks inside, on the inside, want to like join a gang because there's strength in numbers, there's protection in numbers. I don't think a gang is going to take him. Even a white supremacist gang is probably going to say, "Yeah, hey, come hang out with us," and then shank him in the yard or whatever. So I don't think that's going to work. The one angle he might have is he does have allegedly this autism diagnosis, and you know, does constant verbal and emotional torment exacerbate that condition? Is he particularly vulnerable to psychological injury because of that? And could that warrant some kind of change in circumstances based on, you know, requests filed within the prison system? It's at least possible. And so that's something I would explore if I was his counsel.
It's like the only option that you may have at this point. Have you ever seen something like that be argued and be successful? I mean, if you look at most of the inmates in prison, I'm going to guess you have a very high percentage of folks that are, you know, either somewhere on an autism spectrum, personality disorder, mental health issues. I mean, there's a lot of things there that one could say are beyond the control of that individual. And it's a mental health type problem. Historically, prisons aren't that accepting of those things, of even being like accepted as legit. Obviously, they are. We know that they are. But when you weigh it with the horrible things that we know Koberger did, that sort of consideration, you know, doesn't hold a ton of weight, at least in, you know, the general population. But when you're talking about more of an institutional type setting that should realistically consider that sort of thing. I mean, consider it if it wasn't Brian Koberger. If this was someone who's wrongly convicted, hey, let's take Richard Allen, for example, who I believe was wrongly convicted, who I'm sure they're not giving any sort of, you know, leniency to. Do you expect it here for Brian Koberger? Is this something they'd even consider?
You know, I think at the very most, they would kind of go through the motions to give the appearance that they were considering that, and then eventually just say, too bad, bro. But another potential out that Koberger could consider is providing more information. He could come with some kind of proposal to prison officials, to the DOJ, to local prosecutors, and say, hey, I'll tell you all about why I did this and how I did it and who helped me, if anybody, if you'll give me some kind of break here within these prison walls. We saw that with Ghislaine Maxwell, and she's kind of sitting pretty at this nice low security resort. Yeah. And so that's you can think about
that is an interest, like using it as a carrot to dangle out there. But let me ask you this, even if you were to do that, at the end of the day, it seems like a lot of these decisions are made within the prison walls. They're not made in the justice system. They're not made in a courtroom. There's no courtroom saying you're going to be in solitary confinement. That when he gets to the jail, they're like, well, how are we going to handle this here? They make that choice. So I mean, it really just could be somebody who's like, screw him, put him in general population tomorrow. There's not a court that's going to stop that. And by the time if they did, if somebody went and tried to find some sort of injunction on him, can you even put an injunction on that? Is there any way to stop that? Should the warden say, we're moving him? Can a judge say, no, put him back in solitary?
I don't see any viable legal mechanism by which Koberger could contest such actions by prison administration. There is no like ongoing case. And as a prosecutor and defense attorney, I see in court all the time, you know, requests being made by inmates that, hey, I'm not getting my medicine, or hey, I'm not getting proper nutrition, or stuff like that. And the courts just say, hey, the jail is not under my jurisdiction. The prison is not under my jurisdiction. They're not a party to this case. And for Koberger, there is no more case except for appellate proceedings, which is different. So no, a court is not going to step in and in fact would have no jurisdiction to step in and hear such a challenge unless it was some kind of Eighth Amendment cruel and unusual punishment, habeas corpus, something or other. And even then, I think the chances are slim to none.
Is that a problem? I mean, let's take Koberger out of the equation here. I mean, because that is a scary prospect. It's a reality of what we deal with in this country, what we're living with right now, what we're accepting as free people in our country for how we treat those that we have incarcerated. Not everyone incarcerated is guilty. There's a good chunk that are not. To accept that as okay, like they're not getting the medication they need when it is available, when it's basic, simple decencies to humans, not like here you're going to get an extra Snickers tonight or anything, just basic. Okay. So you can survive. And there's plenty of people who didn't murder 4 college students who are behind bars as well. There doesn't seem to be very much oversight. It seems to be kind of, you know, where these prisons are run by whoever you get to run them. Sometimes they're humane and they're run very well. Sometimes, you know, they're horrific and it's run kind of by monsterish human beings that like to be monsters to other people. Again, with not a lot of oversight and not a lot of consequences. This has gone on forever in our country. We've heard this. You wouldn't expect it to be going on in 2025, but it really is.
Oh, it is. Yeah. And I've seen some hellish circumstances, some just indifferent callousness within those prison and jail systems that, like you said, that there's no real way to remedy it. There, you don't have a legal avenue you can pursue. You can't file a motion with the court saying, hey, the jail officials are putting me at risk or something like that. Can't do that. And so, you know, does there need to be some kind of adjudicative process within the institutions themselves? You know, there is when there's misconduct, when inmates are cited for doing something wrong. But what about when the jail staff is doing something wrong? That happens all the time, whether folks want to believe it or not. And so, you know, there is no such process, but should there be some kind of independent oversight or some sort of internal adjudicative, fair, impartial process to address these grievances? You'd have a heck of a lot of grievances from these folks. folks have a lot of time on their hands, but maybe it's worth it.
I mean, it's easy on the outside to go, ah, they had it coming to them. And for some, yes, for Koberger, without a doubt. But we got to look at the bigger picture. I think that's an important thing that maybe this will shed a little bit of light on. It's like, yeah, this is possible. Someone can basically go to death like this. And for Koberger, a lot of us look the other way.
This is Hidden Killers with Tony Bruschi. Here now, Tony Bruschi.
There's something bone chilling about what investigators found on Brian Koberger's phone. Not the kind of chilling that comes from gore or violence, but from vanity. His vanity. Hundreds of shirtless selfies, mirror shots, angles that feel less like someone just documenting their fitness program and more like a man staring at himself with worship. It was so bizarre. Investigators actually compared him to Patrick Bateman, as did we, the day that we saw that photo in the shower with his white little shirt on, looking all American Psycho-y, and I would also say Norman Batesy at the exact same time. The thumbs up. That was a Bundy nod. It's always trying to be other people. A comparison has been thrown around a lot in recent months, but when you pair it with everything else that we now know, his obsession with serial killers like Danny Rawling, his compulsive trophy taking, his eerie detachment, it starts to feel less like a joke and more like a diagnosis. But here's where it gets tricky. Vanity selfies themselves aren't unusual. Entire generations live through the lens of their front-facing cameras. So how do you separate what's normal from what's sinister? What made Koberger's mirror shot so different? Was it the timing, the context, the ritualistic element, snapping that image hours after speaking to his mother, hours after taking a drive back past the crime scene? Or was it something even darker? A way of documenting his transformation into what he believed was a killing machine? That's a conversation we're diving into here, because when you look at those images side by side with his behavior, the secrecy, the obsessive calls to mother and father, the preserved images of unconscious women, you start to see a disturbing pattern. A man who didn't just take selfies, but staged moments for himself. A man who may have treated each photo as a trophy, a private monument to whatever he had just done. And it raises the uncomfortable question, were these just pictures, or were they markers of ritual? Were they snapshots of vanity or snapshots of escalation? That's where I begin with former FBI Special Agent Jennifer Coffendaffer, because the difference between just selfie and evidence of pathology is razor thin. But in Koberger's case, the line may have already been crossed. Let's get into it.
I think the reason he studied all of these killers, and there were many, although he emphasized certainly Rollins, I think, did two downloads of them, one about a week after, I think it was the 19th, and the other one, I think the 22nd or so of December. Mm-hmm. It makes so much sense to me. This is a guy who studied other people, who wanted to be good at his trade. I don't think it was so much of a gorish situation or looking at the deeds of others. It was trying to learn from the mistakes they made. How did they get caught? How did they do everything? Look, Rollins used a K-bar knife. Mm-hmm. And look at the knife of choice for him. So yeah. I thought it was more of a educational download of experience of what he wanted to be good at.
I want to ask you this because I found this kind of interesting when we started hearing about, oh, he took these selfies of himself in the mirror, vanity type shots. What's the difference? And I know there's a difference, but what would you say is the difference between Brian Koberger taking vanity shots and, I don't know, every female human being in the United States of certain ages that also takes vanity shots of themselves, probably far more than Brian Koberger ever took. But what is the difference between those two? Because this is not like it's a odd thing to do. I guess it's more odd to think of Brian Koberger doing it.
Yeah, that's a good point. Look, that generation in their 20s. Mm-hmm. That is what they do. They constantly, I don't care whether they're watching TV, whether they're eating, whether they're at the beach, they are doing selfies nonstop. It's the weirdest thing, but it's definitely that generation. Mm-hmm. And so from that standpoint, it's sort of expected. I think because of the situation that Brian Koberger is in, now we're looking at these selfies and they just seem so creepy. Mm-hmm. I don't know another word, like him in the mirror. I mean, obviously, listen, when you drop 100+ pounds, and I know that was earlier on, but you're really working on your physique, you're running just over 6-minute miles, mm-hmm. you're, you know, doing kickboxing and all the other efforts he made. It seems to me he was probably just admiring how far he had come. But you combine that with what he was getting ready to do, and it does look just like he really was proud of himself and had made a killing machine, sort of, and was admiring it in the mirror.
What made me wonder a little bit about this was the one vanity shot that we all heard about early on, the one we saw, the mirror selfie, the one that I said right away, that looks like Patrick Bateman from American Psycho. And now they're going back going, oh, he was mirroring Patrick Bateman from American Psycho. Oh, yeah. And Psycho too, with the with just being in a shower scene. You have that, and the timing of it is the most disturbing, because we know what he had just done hours before. He had also just been on the phone with mom and dad, or mainly mom, talking about God knows what. And then he takes the selfie and then goes and starts driving back to the scene on the phone with mom. I'm wondering about the other selfies and the timing of them. And I'm wondering what else he was up to in the moments prior to taking those selfies. Does that make you wonder a little bit?
Yeah, it does make me wonder, was he out prowling? Can they show that any connection between the times he did the drive-bys and the surveillance and so forth? Is there any timing matchup with those selfies? Also, I bet it was really a treasure trove to see what all he erased, you mm-hmm. know, purchasing that software and really wiping so clean that even the FBI couldn't find so much afterwards or Cellebrite. I wish we could see what all he got rid of, because I believe he got rid of the most incriminating information. What we're seeing is what he didn't think would get him in trouble.
Yeah. And that's what I wonder about, specifically that if we had, you know, the vehicle data on where he was traveling, what he was doing, not that it's extremely matters so much anymore, but I do wonder if there had been any other crimes committed, or just him breaking into homes that nobody knew about, because there was a lot of suspicion about that, and moving things around, if that was kind of a ritualistic thing. I mean, the guy does kind of seem to have a ritualistic way of doing everything in his life. I would guess that maybe taking those selfies were part of the ritual. Do the thing, go take your little trophy of how strong you are after you did this and how good you think you look, and then, you know, rinse and repeat. I really wonder about that.
Yeah, I think that now we know, obviously, that selfie is so telling, the one in the shower. That's why it makes sense to jump to those possible conclusions, mm-hmm. right? Because he did that. So if he did that in that instance, was he doing it in other instances, maybe with other sorts of crime, even voyeurism?
Yeah.
You know, things along that line. What was he doing to commemorate something that could remind him and trigger him, like a trophy, a picture he took as a trophy? So I think that makes a lot of sense that he certainly could have been doing that.
What does it tell you about the preserved women's images that are also on his phone? He didn't share them. We don't even know exactly what they were, as far as I understand yet. I'm assuming they were just screenshots taken off the internet. I don't know that they were secretly taken. That would make it even creepier, but I doubt that's how it went. Is there any element to Brian Koberger that's normal? I mean, I don't store random women's images on my phone, but I know guys of that age, you know, who would. That's just how some guys are. Does that make it really weird, or is it like, well, that's just, you know, I guess somewhat normal for a 20-some-year-old man that they have pictures of scantily clad women on their phone?
Well, my understanding is some of those pictures involve women scantily clad that are sleeping, that are drunk, that are not moving, that are...
That's a little weird. Know, yeah, that's not normal.
Vulnerable.
Yeah.
And like you said, really, how many people keep strangers' pictures? Mm-hmm. I think some men do, probably more actual nudes.
Yeah.
But my understanding and the reason I think it's particularly weird is because they were unconscious.
Yeah.
And that's always been the connect with him, right? And it's so Bundy-like. Mm-hmm. It's so Rawlings-like because they were definitely into total control. And really Dahmer, while we're at it.
Yeah. Yeah.
Totally controlling a human sexually. And in every way, really. That's what they did, too. So I just, can you imagine, Tony, if law enforcement wouldn't have been so amazing as to catch him within 6 weeks or so, about 6 weeks. Can you imagine what he could have become? Because he did a decent job committing the crime.
Yeah.
If it weren't for one stupid move, and that was that sheep.
What's always so interesting about these characters is, I mean, when they have this MO of believing they have strength, believing they have control, because they basically have a passed out, drunk, or dead victim next to them. I mean, that's just a sign of utter weakness. If the only way you're going to have any sort of interaction with a member of the opposite sex or whoever you're attracted to is when they're drunk or passed out or dead, that's not strength. That's as weak as it gets. That's the only way that you're feeling anything here is when they're helpless and they have zero agency of their own. I always find that interesting. I mean, that's more psychological on the end of this, but it's fascinating how they twist that in their mind as a believed sense of control.
Well, that's because you're so normal, Tony, that you see it as such an oxymoron. But these people see it as total dominance.
Mm-hmm.
They were able to kill somebody. I don't even know what's comparable other than, like an athletic world.
Mm-hmm.
You know, when you win your biggest championship, you can win.
Mm-hmm.
Or something like that, that adrenaline rush.
Sure.
Where you feel like you've conquered something you never thought you could. And that's what I think that feeling has to be. And again, this is from everything we've read, everything I've studied, everything we've learned, interviews and so on. I mean, that's what it's like. It's like this euphoric state of conquering.
Mm-hmm. What stands out most from this part of the conversation isn't the selfies themselves. It's the context. Koberger took these images in a vacuum, never shared them, never posted them, just kept them like relics. When paired with the screenshots of unconscious women, the whole thing kind of shifts from vanity to pathology. It speaks to control, to dominance, to the need to preserve a version of reality only he could enjoy. And that's what makes these images so haunting. They weren't meant for us. They weren't meant for social validation. They were meant for him. Silent trophies of a man who couldn't connect to others, who couldn't function in the real world. So he built a shrine in his own camera roll of himself and his greatness. The irony is staggering. What he saw as strength, the muscle, the control, the frozen image of power was actually all weakness, because the only way he could feel strong was by capturing moments where no one could challenge him, no women rejecting him, no peers outshining him, no real human interaction to test whether he was as powerful as he imagined. Just him alone, flexing to a lens. It's a reminder of how predators, they twist reality. What looks like dominance to them is actually dependency on victims who can't fight back, on images that cannot argue, on trophies that can't expose them. And in Koberger's case, it raises a question that will never fully be answered. Were these pictures simply vanity, or were they a breadcrumb trail, little monuments to his progression into something far, far worse? Either way, they are no longer private. They're evidence, and they show us a man not admiring strength, but documenting weakness. Weakness he mistook for control. Tell me your thoughts in the comment section on YouTube. If you're not already there, just search Hidden Killers with Tony Bruschi and you will find us. You can do that same search wherever you download podcasts to follow us there. Hidden Killers with Tony Bruschi. We greatly appreciate you pressing subscribe and definitely commenting and letting us know your thoughts on this and the many cases that we cover for you right here. What do you think on all that? What do you think about those selfies? Were they more vanity? Are we reading too much into it? It's a lot of questions. And there's a lot more to come in the conversation with Jennifer Coffendaffer. So again, hit subscribe. Until then, I'm Tony Bruschi. We will talk again real soon.
Want more on this case and others? Then press subscribe now. And don't miss a moment of true crime coverage from Tony Bruschi and the Hidden Killers podcast.
Extra Value Meals are back. For just $5, get a savory and sweet sausage, egg, and cheese McGriddles, plus hash browns and a coffee. Only at McDonald's.
For limited time only. Prices and participation may vary. Prices may be higher in Hawaii, Alaska, and California, and for delivery.